In the seventh book of Paradise Lost, Raphael, the affable archangel, warns Adam that disobedience in heaven had been followed by a terrible war and the fall of Satan down to hell. Raphael's point, of course, was that disobedience is dangerous, whether in heaven or in the Garden of Eden. But Adam overlooked the moral in his curiosity about the story, and he asked very eagerly, "How first began this heaven?" Raphael, knowing that the whole story was beyond the bounds of Adam's comprehension, warns him again. This time he warns him against too much curiosity and says, "But knowledge is as food and needs no less her temperance over appetite to know in measure what the mind may well contain." When Rachel proceeds to tell the stars and their distances, curiosity again overcomes Adam, as it did Eve, and he asks how the small and sedentary earth could be the center of so large and moving a universe. And again Raphael cautions him, "Heaven is for thee too high to know what passes there. Be lowly wise. Think only on what concerns thee and thy being. Apt the mind or fancy is to rove unchecked, and of her roving is no end, till warned, or by experience taught, that not to know of at large of things remote from use of pure and subtle, but to know that which before us lies in daily life, is the prime wisdom." The attempt to bound and define and limit that which before us lies in daily life has been a continuous effort of humanists through the centuries, when they, like the angel Raphael, have wanted to keep education within the center of human concerns. But the old Adam in man, with a culpable or a laudable curiosity, has sent him off on tangents, until in wandering mazes lost, he has wearily attempted to find his way back to central concerns. For Plato, the stars and their courses were a much more important symbol of both knowledge and wisdom than the illusory and transient events of a realm of vain shows. And Plato would have been with Adam in asking all sorts of questions about the heavens. He would have asked them partly because of native curiosity and partly because of disillusion and disappointment with the world around him. Some people have said that if you study Plato's Republic, which was his idea of an ideal republic, and you want to know how he developed his ideal, you can tell by having the knowing that the ideal republic was everything that Athens wasn't. So it was a very vigorous disillusionment with Athens that led him to write the Republic. And it was a disillusionment with the transitory nature and the illusory nature of daily knowledge and the affairs around him that led him to turn to the heavens above. And those of you who've been contaminated with philosophy will know how much might be said here about the doctrine of ideas, and I will pass that over. But at any rate, his pupils were to give themselves to mathematics and dialectic, to discovering a reality more abiding than our own little day of laughing and weeping. But Isocrates, a more popular educator, was openly scornful of the image of knowledge in the heavens above. "We couldn't find it," he said, "and we wouldn't know it if we did find it. Wisdom," he declared, "comes from participation in daily life and affairs. And that man is wisest who can make the best guess in an uncertain situation as to what to do next." That's the definition of wisdom that I think is worth pondering on and repeating. That man is wisest who can make the best guess in an uncertain situation as to what to do next. He confesses that it's only a guess. And it's a guess in an uncertain situation. If it's scientific knowledge, then it's not a guess, it's not an uncertain situation, and it's not wisdom. Shall we say then the findings of science are in a way excluded from the realm of wisdom right from the beginning? That is, wisdom lies in the realm of opinion and not in the realm of exact knowledge. For Plato, the uncertainties of opinion were what a wise man would attempt to escape. But for Isocrates, the intuitive choices which a man must make in the realm of the merely probable were the real test of wisdom. Choices springing from scientific knowledge may be admirable, but if he were alive today, I'm sure he would say that the calculation of stresses and strains on a bridge, the diagnosis of cancer, the calculation of the speed of light may be triumphs of the intellect, but they're not wisdom. There's too much certainty about them. Wisdom is intuitive guessing about that which lies before us in daily life. Well, that distinction then, between Plato and the certain knowledge in the heavens above, and Isocrates and the uncertain wisdom of practical affairs, was a dichotomy that I think stamps Plato as not humanist at this particular time in his life, and Isocrates as humanist. Last week I was sitting on a board of judges to interview a group of scholars competing for rather large scholarships. And there were about 10 of us on the committee. And one of the boys mentioned that he was very fond of Dostoevsky and started to talk about Dostoevsky a little bit, and I asked him a few questions about that. And then he said, of course, I disagree with his philosophy entirely. I think he was a hopeless sentimentalist. I don't believe in his emphasis upon suffering and renunciation. But they're marvelous books. And I said, well, how do you judge a book? If you say its philosophy is false, do you mean you can extract from a book its false philosophy and throw it away and say that what's left is still a great book? And he said, oh, certainly, there are lots of great books with false philosophies. And there are lots of books that aren't so good that have pretty sound philosophies, but I wouldn't care to read them. I thought that was fairly mature for a high school senior, and was very well pleased with him, and thought in my own mind, well, he has what I've been looking for in this thing that I call a knowledge of central importance. He's thinking about things that are centrally important in the destiny of mankind. And two of the members of our committee from the science department spoke up right away and said, after he's gone, and said, well, that boy is clear off center. He's hopelessly one-sided. We couldn't give a scholarship to a boy that's interested in queer things like that. But there's nothing about that that would lead you to suspect him of any capacity for leadership or any acquaintance with what's going on in the world. And I thought, well, shades of Irving Babbitt and the humanists in general, and I subsided into defeated silence. You see what a different atmosphere we're in from that of Dr. Johnson, whose calm assumption that we were all moralists and ought to be all the time. That was our character as liberally educated people. Well, in these references then to Milton and to Plato and to the Hebrews, there is a kind of belief that there is a supernatural realm which has some influence upon our wisdom. And then there is the great central realm of daily affairs. There is that division between them. When we jump from there down to the 19th century, we find that realm of the supernatural still there, but playing a much more shadowy part. In the 19th century, Huxley fought the battle for basing morals upon knowledge of the world about us, and insisted upon the ethical significance of science and its large place as a part of culture. The chief business of mankind, he declared, is to learn the order of nature and to govern themselves accordingly. And here I am going to quote four or five lines, and I see at least four or five people in the audience that I remember from old Cornell days who could rise up and be a verse-speaking choir and join me in the memorized delivery of this passage. I know, and I remember how we used to love to recite it at Cornell. Education is the instruction of the intellect in the laws of nature, under which name I include not merely things and their forces, but men and their ways, and the fashioning of the affections and of the will into an earnest and loving desire to move in harmony with those laws. And he didn't seem to think there was anything about his preoccupation with science that forbade him to talk about a loving and earnest desire to move in harmony with those laws. Well, Matthew Arnold, of course, had little insight into science. His source of authority for passing judgments on that which lies before us in daily life was not an acquaintance with the world about him, but an acquaintance with the best that had been said and thought in the world. When he ventured somewhat dogmatically to review some books in fields in which he was not really competent, he justified himself by saying that he judged these books by their healthy or unhealthy effect upon men's emotions and aspirations. A humanist who knew intimately the master spirits of the past could speak with authority, he thought, upon men's emotions and aspirations. The function of the critic was to interpret the effect of new knowledge upon old emotional values. He could not, of course, assess the validity of the new knowledge. He would leave that to the mere experts. But he could tell what hopes and aspirations we must have to preserve our mental health, and he could tell how hopes and aspirations could be protected from hasty or false interpretations of new knowledge. Armed with a sort of cultural history of the human heart, he could face the specialist without dismay. And facing specialists without dismay is no small part of the equipment of an educated man. In criticism of Arnold as a humanist, where I think he perhaps falls short of what I would like to see in contemporary humanism, was the fact that I think he was a little like Plato in not liking the world that he saw around him, and I expect a lot of us to feel the same way. If I can illustrate what I mean, he made a very vigorous speech in opposition to what was called the burial bill. That is, in his time in England, one who didn't belong to the Church of England couldn't be buried in the churchyard of the Church of England. And there was a bill introduced to allow people who were not Episcopalians to be buried in those churchyards. He opposed it very vigorously because he said, a Church of England burial in which the service is read from the prayer book is a public lesson in good manners. And all over England, daily, these burials in which the prayer book is read are informing these rather vulgar and Philistine Englishmen what beautiful words and good manners are. But if you will let Methodists be buried in the Church of England, they'll do or say most anything. And you can't tell what might happen. And that high standard of manners in England is seriously threatened. Well, I should say that Arnold felt that in his knowledge of the best books and the best authors and the best spirits of the past, he had a kind of touchstone which he would sort of force upon the barbarian Philistine populace of his day, force it down their throats and say, now if you want to be good human beings, read these books and act the way they say, and you will preserve the great tradition of the humanities. And I'm trying to think that the genteel tradition is either fortunately or unfortunately, so nearly dead now, that you don't have those kinds of books to read. And if you were to read all of the books aloud that are read in the curriculum today in modern literature, I'm sure Arnold wouldn't think that it was a public exhibition of good manners. So perhaps the humanist of the kind of Arnold was more authoritative than we like, more dogmatic in his appeal to the past than we like. Yet I have a great deal of sympathy with his statement that you could get, if you only realize it, a flow of fresh ideas continually from these books of the past. I think that before leaving him, I haven't, don't intend to say very much about religion and the religious spirit, but having mentioned that in the earlier humanists, there was nearly always this appeal to a power higher than ourselves, and that appeal has been somewhat less in recent books. I want to just make a statement about the function of religion in general education, or the place of it, or in liberal education, which is just a brief statement. And I am going to take this statement from a little book called Educating Liberally, by Dwight Hudson, whom some of you here have known. And I think we may say that, well, if you accept it as I do, that it will sort of take the place in contemporary general education of what was a highly different realm to the earlier humanists. What the object of reverence may or must be if the religious attitude is to be maintained, I shall not venture to specify, although I have already indicated my opinion that it must be something more comprehensive than the nation or the race. And perhaps I should quote from an earlier place on that page. He says, by a religious attitude, I mean a sense of being bound by ties and obligations, ties of obligation, and linked by modes of communication to some object greater than oneself and greater than one's class, state, or race. And then he goes on to say, in academic circles and among the liberally educated, one meets people for whom the highest object of thought and heart's devotion is humanity, considered in its ideal possibilities. There is what is technically known as religious humanism. For myself, I am led to contemplate a life wherein humanity itself is put into perspective.